expensive.
Okay, so we're at class three of chapter eight of the guide, and I thought I'd start before we continue on. This is the real meat. This class is the real meat of the whole chapter, and so I haven't selected so many verses for this so that we have time to, you know, to give it a go. Because in this chapter, he talks about the method, the meditational method. So you could say the object of meditation in this chapter is learning how to equalize yourself. Learning how to equalize yourself with all beings. Or you could even say it stronger. Learning how to identify yourself with all beings. And then the method is exchanging self for others. Which, you know, kind of like achieves the object. You know, it's a kind of a chicken and egg thing. You have to have the strong sense that everyone is equal. Everyone is exactly the same in order for you to exchange self for others. But the cash out, the result of that practice of exchanging self for others, is a strong, even stronger realization that we're all the same. So I thought I'd reel it back a little bit and say something about, you know, what's being presumed here, the sort of prerequisites for a practice like this. And so, you know, we all come to the spiritual life broken, you know, unhappy in one way or another. That's why you come. I mean, you know, I don't know anyone who is like a well-adjusted, happy person who then says, oh, I need some, you know, spiritual help. Because there aren't ultimately no well-adjusted, happy people without spiritual help, ultimately. So we come wounded. The walking wounded limp into the Dharma Center. And then we learn some foundational kind of techniques on how to feel better about ourselves. And that's important. I mean, the spiritual life is like building an edifice. You know, you have to have pour the concrete for the foundation, and then you build the first floor, and then you build the second floor, and like that. And these floors are not mutually exclusive. And it's not like, well, you know, I already poured the foundation, and I've got my first floor up, now I can forget about the foundation. You know, I'm always going back to, you know, reinforce the concrete there on the bottom. So the foundational level is to learn how to feel better about yourself. And in that sense, it's like therapy. The spiritual life is like therapy. Because, you know, that's what therapy is, I guess. Right? I was in therapy once, and a long time ago now, but for a while. And what you do, and for those of you who haven't been to therapy, is that you pay somebody to listen to how unhappy you are. You know, and so you sit there and whinge for, 45 minutes or so, and they say, that's all, you know, $150, please, or probably more now, go home. And, and then they give you some elementary advice, hopefully, on how to make yourself feel better. Well, the spiritual life is like that. At the foundational level, you know, the spiritual life teaches you ways to make yourself feel better. And the principal way of that is living an ethical life. Living an ethical life. Stop lying to people. Stop cheating people. You know, stop hurting people. And that's the foundation. And without that foundation, nothing. Nothing. So sometimes people, you know, they build their first, second, and third floors and stuff, and they forget about the foundation, and then the whole thing starts to crumble. Because if that ethical foundation isn't there, first of all, and isn't constantly being reinforced, the edifice will definitely fall. Definitely. So that's the elementary thing, that, you know, and the ethical life can be summed up very, very simply. Don't hurt others. Treat other people as you would like to be treated. The golden rule, right? Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Don't treat other people in ways that you wouldn't want to be treated yourself. And treat other people the way you do want to be treated yourself. And, you know, with that foundation in place, you start feeling better. Definitely. You start feeling better about yourself. And And when you feel better about yourself, the events that are out of your control, certainly out of your immediate control, the various, you know, kind of waves that roll in on your shore, you know, don't seem so formidable anymore. You know, the same kind of event that once threw you for a big loop and, you know, made you go to bed for 3 months, sucking your thumb off, you know, feeling how depressed you are, well, you take it more in stride. So the purpose of spiritual life isn't to not have any unexpected things ever happen to you again. That's unrealistic. Number one, unrealistic. And number two, undesirable. Okay, so I'll just like go through that a little bit. It's like waves, okay? It's like waves. Some people get the idea that the spiritual life is to build a wave machine at what, like one of those water parks. You know, maybe they have one at Sentosa Island, maybe by this point, where you go into a swimming pool and there's a machine that makes the same wave over and over and over again, right? Very predictable, very, you know, right? And it's boring. So, number one, life doesn't allow for wave machines. Okay? It's just not going to happen. You're not going to be able to predict everything that's going to happen to you. You see? And number two, even if you could, did I mention that you can't? Even if you could, you wouldn't want it. It would take all the interest out of life. All the surprise, all the wonder, all the terror, but all the wonder too, you see? So the foundational level is learning how to ride with any wave that comes along. Not how to control the waves, but how to deal with life. How to deal with life in a much more sort of sophisticated and healthy way than to just be battered over and over again by the waves, you see? With no life preserver, no surfboard. You know, surfboards are life preservers, actually, as anybody who's gone surfing knows. You know, they're flotation devices, first and foremost. So you know, the Dharma is a flotation device. It helps you keep above the water. But it doesn't, it's not a wave machine, okay? So the foundation is there. And when you start feeling better about yourself, better able to cope with life, better able to cope with life, then you feel better about yourself, and your sense of self strengthens. Your sense of capability of being able to deal with whatever life throws at you increases. And then you have what we could call good, healthy self-esteem. Good, healthy self-esteem. And that's extremely important. That also, I would say, is foundational. Good, healthy self-esteem is foundational for any further progress on a spiritual life. I once had a chat with a Tibetan Buddhist who was also a therapist, worked at UCLA in Los Angeles. And I asked him straight out, I said, like, do you think that you can practice Buddhism without a good, healthy sense of, you know, self? He said, definitely not. Definitely not. So if you have a self-esteem problem, and we all have some self-esteem problems, okay? But I mean a serious one, you know, full-on depression or something like that. You got to fix that before you can, like, sit in classes on Chapter 8 and Chapter 9 of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life and get much out of it, you see? Because these practices assume healthy self-esteem, strong sense of self. You have to have a strong sense of self to be able to get rid of self. If there's no strong sense of self, there's nothing to get rid of, you see. The second level, you could say, of the spiritual life is once the foundation is in place, then you start eroding, you start deconstructing the self that you esteem, that you got the esteem for. But if that self-esteem isn't there, then there's nothing to deconstruct, you see. So this text assumes that foundation. It assumes that you have that good, healthy sense of a individual self. I'm talking about, you know, good, healthy sense of feeling okay about you. You know, which doesn't mean that everything's fine or everything's perfect or, you know, you think that you're perfect in some way, but you have a basic sort of love for yourself. Can't love others until you love yourself. And you can't love others if you only love yourself. So that's the second part. The second part is to learn to love others as you love yourself. And to think of others as lovable as you are. Right? So sometimes, you know, people have a good enough self-esteem, but then they get arrogant and they get all kind of self-absorbed. And that's another problem. That's a different problem. So, you know, it's kind of the flip side of the low self-esteem is over self-esteem. So, you know, one or the other. And so, you know, you start with fixing the self-esteem, and then you start undoing the self-esteem. And that's where we are in this text, is assuming that the self-esteem is there, that you have that good, healthy, you know, sense of self, of being okay, in order to give it up, in order to release it, or you could say better, expand it. You know, so the spiritual life is hierarchical in a way. It has to be hierarchical. So you have to build the foundation first. And the foundation, as I mentioned before, the foundation, the way that you will ultimately feel better about yourself. I mean, you can go and pay people money and go get therapy, and that's very important sometimes. It's very necessary sometimes for people to avail themselves of the therapeutic process. You know, we live in a time and a place where, you know, there are trained professionals who can, you know, address the issues that you have, mental issues that you have. But the spiritual life also has that function, and it does it actually in a slightly different way. I mean, the therapeutical process, by and large, I mean, you know, there's many different kinds of therapy, but by and large, the therapeutical process involves focusing on yourself. Focusing on yourself. And the spiritual foundational process involves, like, not focusing so much on yourself and thinking about the impact that you have on other people. That's ethics. That's ethics. You see? If you're just focusing on yourself without the ethical sort of structure or framework, then you turn into another kind of a monster. You know, just a sociopath, really. Somebody who just doesn't care about anybody else. So even at the foundational level, there's this kind of a kind of inclusion of otherness, other directedness, thinking about other people and your impact, the impact of your actions on others. That's ethics. And then we get to the, you know, kind of next level of things, which is to start thinking about others as at least equal to yourself, if not more important to yourself. So last class we got to the part in chapter 8 where he's talking about the equality, fundamental equality. And that's true at all levels, okay? I mean, fundamental equality means, you know, economically, you know, somebody might have less money than you do, but that doesn't make them a lesser person. Somebody might have, you know, not as nice a car or not as nice a house or, you know, all of these sort of gauges that we have for distinguishing ourselves from other people are all really kind of just, you know, irrelevant ultimately. Can't take it with you, you know? So you can, like, have all kinds of money and nice cars and big fancy apartments and, you know, condos and houses, and all of that will be lost. You know, if not before, certainly at the time of death. It's just it's just temporary. It's just adventitious, just a sort of an accident in a way that you have these things. So this, you know, this idea of equality, I think, is really, really important when it comes to the spiritual life. Of treating other people, no matter what their circumstances, you know, no matter whether they're rich or poor, whether they're, you know, this race or that race, this ethnicity or that ethnicity, you know, we're all alike. We're all fundamentally alike. And that includes spiritually. So, you know, the other aspect, the other arena in which we can get all, like, high and mighty, you know, feeling that we're better than other people is spiritually. So then, you know, people will, well, you know, oh, I'm not into money, you know, I like poor people, and, you know, all of that, and, you know, and I'm not into, like, class, you know, that's all. But, you know, I'm a yogi. I'm a meditator. I'm a Buddhist. I'm a this or that. And the rest of them are atheists, or secular humanists at best, just slobs, you know, basic spiritually slobs, okay? And that is not a spiritual position to take, okay? That's just the ego posing, you know, in another guise, the ego posing as a spiritual practitioner in order to, you know, feel superior to other people. And that's at every level, okay? I was, you know, talking recently to some group about mystical experiences, you know? And, you know, I've been teaching the Dharma for, I don't know, 15 years now. And, you know, I encounter a lot of people who come and talk to me personally and tell me, you know, about their, you know, experiences, spiritual experiences, mystical experiences. First thing I always wonder is, why are you telling me this? You know, why? What's the point exactly? And, you know, the suspicion, you can't read other people's minds, don't know for sure, but the suspicion is always that they're trying to impress you. Look what an important person I am. I saw Jesus, or I saw emptiness directly, or whatever kind of like language they put on the mystical experience. There's really only one mystical experience. And then there's lots of different interpretations of what that one mystical experience is. You know? So that's one thing. And then if the mystical experience hasn't made you more humble, more like in touch with other people, more connected to other people, well, what's the point of it? Just useless, you know? So that's one thing. And the second thing I wanted to say about mystical experience, you know, when we're talking about equality, right? We're talking about basic equality and spiritual equality. It is my strong impression that everyone's had mystical experiences. BFD, you know that? Yeah. Well, big and deal, and then the F in between. No, really. I mean, you know, if you get to know somebody pretty well, and they trust you, and you know, you trust them, and all like that, you find out everyone's had like incredible experiences, incredible experiences. When I first started teaching in Ireland, which was a long time ago. Oh my God, the Irish, they've all talked to Jesus. They're talking to Jesus all the time. You know, Mary comes, they talk to her too, and you know, the little people are running around, hi, the leprechauns. They're just like, oh, it's a big deal. It's like no big deal for them. And then like we sort of like have a, you know, kind of a good meditation, we go, oh, I think I might be realized. I might be a realized being. And then you get this like high and mighty attitude, spiritual high and mighty attitude. A real mystical experience will not increase your ego, but just the opposite. Just the opposite. It will make you feel like nothing. You know? That's the point of the mystical experience. That's the real takeaway from the mystical experience. And if you interpret it and use it to make you feel superior to other people and to give labels to yourself, oh, I'm a mystic, or I'm a, you know, bodhisattva, or I'm a this, or I'm a that, you know, I'm a realized being, then you've missed the point of the mystical experience. And you're just using it. Another form of spiritual materialism. Another form of what Chogyam Trungpa called spiritual materialism. Using the spiritual life to enhance your ego and to make you feel better than other people. So actually, I was, you know, we were talking about, Cindy and I were talking about this in terms of the Uttara Tantra, which is another text. I'll be teaching this text on this tour in Germany. I've taught it before to others. The Uttara Tantra is probably the most important text, extant text on Buddha nature. And Buddhahood. We've talked about Buddha nature, right? The fact that we all have Buddha nature. Shanti Davis says that too. It's the antidote for low self-esteem in sixth chapter. Seventh chapter. And so the Uttara Tantra, you know, does this whole thing for in chapter one about, you know, Buddha nature, and we all have it, and what it's like, and so forth. And then at the end of chapter one, he says, you may be wondering why I'm teaching this in the first place. Why do we need to know about Buddha nature? And he gives, like, several reasons, but one of them is, huh? Five. So, and one of them, that's okay.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. She's like my external drive. One of the reasons why the text says it's teaching Buddha nature is for bodhisattvas. If you achieve bodhicitta, if you really have that change of mindset, you know, and become a real bodhisattva, the text says you might start to think that you're better than other people. You might start to think that you're superior to those who don't have bodhicitta. And therefore, we're teaching the Buddha nature. Because the Buddha nature of a bodhisattva is exactly the same as the Buddha nature of an insect. Let alone a non-bodhisattva human. See, Buddha nature is universal. And nobody has more of it than anyone else. It is, you know, another kind of form of the great spiritual democracy. We're all the same. In that we all have the capability of being awakened. All equally, okay? So that's what I wanted to say about spiritual inequality. And it's a very big danger. The other kinds of inequalities are obviously dangerous. You know, to feel superior to other people because you have more money than they do, or have a better education than they do, or, you know, are more eloquent, or, you know, whatever it is, more beautiful. You know, all of these, like, you know, temporary fleeting qualities that you will definitely lose anyway, that you then overestimate and say, this makes me a superior person. But that's also true in the spiritual life. And one has to be careful, especially long-time practitioners. The longer the practitioner, the more tendency there is to feel that you are spiritually superior to other people. And that is not the spiritual life. When that starts to creep up in your mind, then you know you are no longer practicing a spiritual life. So this part, let's get to it, okay? That was enough of that rant. We'll start with verse 129. This is also a very famous verse. Many of you have heard it before. Whatever suffering there is in the world comes from the selfish desire for happiness. Sva sukha ichaya. Icha means desire, sva means self, sukha means happiness, desire for your own happiness. And he says, whatever suffering, you know, comes to you in the world, whatever suffering you experience comes because you're only worried about your own happiness. And then the next shoe drops. Whatever happiness there is in the world comes from the desire for the happiness of others. Whatever happiness you achieve in the world comes from thinking about the happiness of others. And, you know, every time I read this verse, I always think, like, you know, most of us would come to this verse and say, there must be a typo here. Right? They must have balled it up somehow in the editorial process. Whatever suffering there is comes from not worrying about my own happiness, isn't it? That's how we usually think. If I suffer, it's because I haven't attended to my own happiness enough. So I better, like, you know, kind of be even more self-centered than I am already. And he's saying, no, just the opposite. Your unhappiness comes from self-centeredness. Your happiness comes from other-directedness, from thinking about other people and their happiness. And, you know, even though we have the tendency to, like, turn it all around, I think we also all have experience of the truth of this verse. We all have some experience of the real happiness, the real sukha, that comes when you finally manage to overcome your selfishness and do something for someone else. And then you get that warm glow in the belly. You know what I mean? That warm glow of going, wow. You know. I've finally thought about somebody other than myself for a change. You know? Like if you visit, I used to do, you know, have this experience. My father was in an old folks home. He was in assisted care living for several years. And I would go like once a year or something, you know, and visit him for 3 days. Like no big thing out of my life, really. But, you know, it was like the highlight of the year for him. He would like parade me around to all the other old folks and say, you know, look who came, look, you know, somebody visited me. You know, somebody took the time out of their life to come and spend a few hours, you know, of their precious time to, you know, to, and I wasn't getting anything out of it, you know. It was pretty altruistic, actually. Yeah, I mean, I didn't do it all that much, not like bragging here or anything like that, but, you know, it was an example in my own life of doing something for just a little while for someone else. I felt great. Felt great to do that, you know. And maybe you all have experience of that, you know. You give somebody the right gift, you know? You think about, you don't just go to Amazon.com and find out what the top 10 gifts are that thousands of millions of people are buying, but you actually think about, you know, well, what would this other person like? You know, what would, and then, you know, and you go and you find, and then, you know, they open the present and they like, they see, oh, wow. And, you know, you feel great, right? Because you've gotten out of yourself for a second. You know, for a few seconds and thought about somebody else. So all happiness comes from thinking about others, and all suffering comes from thinking about ourselves all the time. What's the point of so much talk, he says. Okay, now he's going to say, all right, 130 verses of chit-chat here. Let's get down to it pretty quick here now. What's the point of so much talk? Just look at the difference between the spiritually immature. Remember I told you that word, bala. Bala means child. Just look at the difference between the spiritually immature who looks after his or her own interest and the sage, the muni, who works for the interests of others. How could someone who does not exchange his own happiness or her own happiness for the suffering of others even find happiness in samsara, in cyclic existence? Let alone achieve awakening. So even in this world, even in this life, let alone, you know, in Buddhahood, even in this life, it doesn't make us happy. It doesn't make us happy to just think about ourselves all the time. We are a house divided. Every person is kind of schizophrenic. On the one hand, we know this. On the one hand, we know that we should be more caring for other people, more altruistic, more thinking about them. But then there's this other half that goes, yeah, but what about me? What about me? Right? Warring, at war with each other. You know? There's a famous verse in Romans, in the Bible, in the New Testament. Paul says, I know what I should do. I know I should try to be a good person. But I don't do it. I don't get me. He says, I don't understand myself. I know I should do this kind of thing, and yet I don't do it. I know I should try to be a good person, and yet I still am a selfish pig. And we're all like this, right? We're all just kind of schizophrenic, confused, very confused. So we have to be reminded, you know, you might think of it as the angel and the devil inside, okay? Like, or on two shoulders, you know, like the angel on one shoulder whispering in your ear and the devil on the other shoulder. What about me? What about me? What about me? And the other is like, be nice to others. Be, you know, care. And we got to give the angel an amplifier, a bullhorn, to make sure that we're listening to that side of things so that this side is drowned out. Whether in regard to the future or even in this visible world, one does not accomplish the goal when you're selfish like that. The master doesn't pay wages to a servant who doesn't do his work. So the work here is to, you know, is to overcome selfishness. And without that, no pay. No payoff. The deluded turning their backs on the festival of happiness, visible or unseen, that comes from making each other happy, take on the horrible suffering that comes from making each other suffer. Two ways to live here, okay? Two ways to live. Either join the festival of happiness, right? The festival in which everyone is trying to make everyone else's life easier. Or join the, what does he call it, the horrible suffering of everyone just at each other's throats all the time. Everyone just aggravating each other. So which side are you on, you know? Kind of a, it's a crossroads. It's a, what do you call it, fork in the road. And you can go down one side or you can go down the other. And which one's going to pay off, you see? That's, for me, this is always the question when it comes to spiritual life or spiritual technique. What's going to pay off for me? You know, really. The Dalai Lama loves to do this. I've heard the Dalai Lama many, many times. And, you know, I've noticed that he often structures his talks in saying, okay, I'm going to talk about the eighth chapter of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. But before I start, let me tell you what's in it for you. Let me tell you what you can how you can benefit from what I'm going to say, you know, because we're all self-interested. So there's a difference between stupid self-interest and enlightened self-interest. Stupid self-interest is what we almost always are following. Stupid, you know. But enlightened self-interest is fine. You know, how will I be happy, really? How can I really be happy? And nobody in the spiritual life, no, you know, in no religion anywhere, legitimate, you know, authentic religion, has ever said, you will be happier by thinking about yourself more. I mean, I challenge you to bring me a scripture that says that somewhere, you know? I mean, not counting like New Age, you know, newfangled stuff. Not all New Age stuff is bad, but, you know, sometimes it gets a little self-centered. But the authentic ancient traditions are all in one voice, always say, happiness comes not from selfishness, but from altruism. Happiness, your happiness, comes not from thinking about yourself more. We think about ourselves enough already. But from thinking about others. So this is not unique to Buddhism or Mahayana Buddhism to say these things. This is universal. Universal spiritual truth. So, you know, we all want to be happy. We all want to live happy lives. Well, why don't we pay attention to the one voice that all the religions have been, you know, speaking in for millennia when it comes to the real methods for being happy? The deluded, turning their backs. Okay. And since all the calamities, sufferings, and fear in the world come from grasping to the self, atma parigraha, parigraha. Graha comes from a Sanskrit root grah or grub, and it comes directly into English as grab. Grabbing, and pari means around. Like a pari comes into English as peri, as in periscope or perimeter. So grasping around, and here's grasping around to the self especially, atma. Since all the calamity, all your suffering, all fear comes from grasping, why do I do it? Why do I do it then? You know, we're just illogical. We're not logical beings. We like to think of ourselves as logical beings, but if it is true that we all want to be happy and all want to avoid suffering, then why do we do exactly the opposite of that? Time after time after time again. Grasping to selfishness. Without abandoning the self, you can't get rid of suffering. Without stopping thinking about yourself all the time, you can't get rid of suffering. Partly because as we think about ourselves all the time, we're not thinking about how happy we are. You know, when we do a little scan, when we do it like that, which we're always doing, how am I? Am I too hot? Am I too cold? Did I get nice tea or did I get, you know, I got nice tea by the way. When we do that scan, almost always ends up with something wrong, right? So always something wrong. You can try, you know, just check. You know, physically, always something wrong. Physically. I mean, when there's not something big wrong, like, you know, major cancer or something like that, there's always something wrong, right? Got a sore foot or got a little, you know, scratch here. You know. It's always something wrong physically. What about mentally? Oh my God. Always like some discontent, you know? It's a little hot in here now. I got sweat. Oh, I'm sweating. You know, always something. Always something. So, without abandoning the self, without, you know, abandoning this
preoccupation with ourselves.
Can't get rid of suffering. Just as if you don't steer clear of the fire, you can't avoid getting burnt. So here the grasping to self, the selfishness is regarded as a fire. And if the fire is stoked, or you get near it, you will definitely get burned. As long as we keep stoking the ego, stoking the self, we will definitely suffer. Definitely. And so, in order to assuage the suffering of myself and others, I give myself to others and take on others as myself, exchanging self for others. Hey, mind, that's actually in Sanskrit. Hey in Sanskrit, H-E, you see it in the end of the first line there of verse 137, towards the end? Hey in Sanskrit means hey in English. Hey, mana. Hey, mind, make this resolution. I am fully bound to others. And the resolution is I will pay attention to the fact that I already am fully bound to others. None of us can live without others. We are defined by our relationships. We don't have relationships. We're defined by our relationships. Fully bound to others. From now on, you must not think of anything else. This is like typical, Shantideva, just getting all medieval now. You must not think of anything else than bringing about the welfare of all living beings. Must not think of anything else but how to serve others. Das means servant, right? Dasa. So you're sarva dasa. Sarva means everything, everybody. Not, Krishna Das and, Shiva Das and all these Dasas, Sarva Das. I am the servant of everyone, of everything. It's not right to look after one's own welfare with eyes that belong to them. So you've just given yourself away, okay? You've given yourself, which includes your body, in service to all other living beings. So now you don't own yourself. You don't own even your body. Your body is not yours anymore. So it's not right to look after one's own welfare with eyes that belong to them. It's not right to pursue one's own welfare with hands that belong to others. Giving yourself away entirely. Therefore, having put living beings foremost, whatever you see on this body, whatever this, kind of functions this body can perform, is to be torn away from it and employed for the benefit of others. Okay, so he's dedicating, his body and all his actions to the service of others. Now we get to the method, full on, okay? So this is a little tricky. I'll read the verse and then we'll go through. I put little headings here. The following verses are on so that we can keep it straight because it's a little, like I said, tricky. It's confusing. You will find it's confusing, I think. I found it confusing. Placing your own identity into those who are inferior and the identity of those who are superior into yourself, cultivate envy and pride with a mind free of scruples. The free of scruples thing, it means without hesitation, and he reiterates that later on in the text. Don't have any hesitation about this practice, which is kind of like important because, it seems pretty funky because you're using mental afflictions. It is a meditation in which you are not trying to overcome mental afflictions. You're trying to cultivate them. So, obviously, the Surgeon General, like in America, they put the Surgeon General is the big doctor, the government doctor, puts warnings on all the cigarette packs, If you smoke, you will die, basically, is what it says. It was mandated by law. In Australia, the same thing. Is it here? In Singapore, probably too. Yeah. So this is kind of like, you'd think there'd be a Surgeon General's warning here about, mucking around with the mental afflictions. But no, he says, have no hesitation about doing this. It's a very radical method, okay, for achieving bodhicitta, for achieving an awakened mind, awakening to the fact of interdependence,
Awakening to the fact of connection with all other beings. Awakening to a re-identification. Moving from the individual self to a universal self. A universal understanding of who you are. So here's how it goes, kids. There's one other that he doesn't mention here for some reason. He mentions it in the verses, as you'll see. Exchanging yourself, so first of all, exchange yourself with someone who you regard as inferior to you. Put yourself in their place. And then look back at you. Okay? So the pronoun here, the personal pronouns get kind of all confused. Because you no longer become you, but become them. You become someone that you feel like way smarter than, or way more beautiful than, or way more like better at yoga than, or, you know, richer than, in some way or another that you feel is inferior to you. And then you take on their identity. So that's the new you. You could call it you point two or something. Point one, or how's that go?
When you,
yeah. And then you point two looks back at you point one. And then you, so with envy. Okay, with envy and resentment. So the meditation is to fully inhabit the person that you feel superior to and look back at the old you with their eyes and generate envy and resentment against the former you. Okay, you got it? Mm-hmm. So you're using envy as a path. You're using envy, because you know, eventually you're going to have to come back to you one. So you're practicing being you two, right? And looking at you one with envy and resentment, and then coming back to you one and feeling like, oh, this is how other people must feel towards me. Other people who, you know, I regard as inferior. This is how they must feel towards me. What an awful feeling that must be. See? Okay? Then the second sort of meditation, second phase, is equals. And he doesn't mention it in this verse 140, but he mentions it in the following verses. So that exercise is to, you know, think about somebody that's more or less your peer, that you're equal with, feel equal with, and generate rivalry. So again, you one who feels like they're more or less like equal to someone else, more or less in competition. Like, so somebody at the workplace maybe would be really good. You know, somebody who's like competing for the same kind of promotion or something like that. And then put your you one into the perspective of you two, who's the rival, and then look back at you one with resentment, with competition, with a competitive sense. Okay? And then when the meditation ends, you go back to you one and feel, oh, that's how they must feel about me. They must feel that I'm their rival. They must feel like, you know, they have to always like compete with me and stuff like that. You see what I mean? Then the third phase is to think about someone superior to you. And there are people superior to you, okay? In one sense or another. There are richer people. There are more beautiful people. There are way smarter people than you. You know, in one sense or another, there's somebody who's better than you. And then you put yourself, you one, put yourself in you two's position and generate pride. You see, pride. Well, I of course I'm smarter than them. Well, why are they so envious of me? Well, this person's not as smart. I can't help it. I'm smarter than them. You see? So you're using pride as a path. The first one, when you exchange yourself with someone that you know is sort of lesser than you in one regard or another, you're cultivating envy as a path. Envy. And then when you switch it up and you exchange yourself with someone who's better than you in some regard or another, you cultivate pride as a path. And then you come back and say, well, you know, this is how that person must feel. That person must feel like, well, you know, can't help it that I'm smarter. I can't help it that I'm more beautiful than they are. Can't help it that I'm richer. Why are they so envious of me? Okay? It's tricky, a little tricky. So I thought we'd go through the verses on each one of those types of exchanging self for other, and then actually try it. A little lab this afternoon, tonight, okay? A little laboratory experiment. And this is obviously a tricky meditation, and you have to do it over and over again. And you know, it's, I think you'll find, as I have, that number one, it's hard to really put yourself in other people's positions. You know, we say that we can do that. We say, well, I can put myself in some, what the expression, you put yourself in someone else's shoes, you know? But it's actually quite hard. It's quite hard to distance yourself, to see yourself from someone else's perspective. So that's really the trick of the meditation, is to really inhabit that other person, you too, and really inhabit that, you know, identity. And then with those eyes, look back at you one, the former you. And, okay? So let's try it, okay? I'll read through the verses. We'll read through the verses on each one of these practices, and then we'll try it. So verse 141 is on exchanging self for those who are inferior to you. Or you could say, what it looks like from the point of view of someone who envies you. What you look like from the point of view of someone who is envious of you, in one sense or another, okay? He is honored. That would be you one. Everyone okay with the you one, you two thing? Okay, so now you're you two, and you're talking about you one. Okay? He is honored, and I'm not. I don't have the things he has. He is praised while I am belittled. He is happy, but I'm miserable. Getting into the envy thing yet? I do all the work while he comfortably relaxes. He has high status in the world while I, who have no good qualities, am debased. What can I, so then the person says, it's not my fault I don't have any good qualities. What can I do? I don't have, what can I do with it? What can one do without any good qualities? You know, so I don't have any money. What can I do? I don't have any money. Like that, you know, if you're doing the economic one. And then he says, but yeah, wait, but everyone has some good qualities. So, you know, back to you one again. This is the voice of you two. Everyone okay? It's confusing. It can get really confusing here. So this is the voice of you two looking back at you one. So then you two says, like, okay, so, you know, I don't have as much money, or I'm not as good as yoga, or, you know, I'm not as intelligent or something like that. But everyone has some good qualities, right? Everyone has, you know, so why is this person, also known as you one, feeling so superior to me just because they're more intelligent? You know, I know how to do car mechanics better than they do. Probably, right? You know, everyone has some good qualities. I was, you know, thinking when I was reviewing this, you know, I used to be in the academic world, and I did a lot of study in graduate school, especially of the history of cultural anthropology, comparative cultures. And in the early 20th century, when that science was really starting to develop, they had a whole system, a hierarchical system of culture. Guess who came on top? Our culture, the culture that the anthropologists were from, was the summit of all cultural evolution. It was actually an application of Darwinian evolutionary theory to culture. So they had this whole kind of idea that cultures progressed evolutionary, although some cultures got stuck. You know, and the ones that got the stuckest were called the primitive cultures. And you could find them, the ideal type of the primitive culture was the Aboriginals in Australia. You know, who hadn't changed for 20,000 years or something. And so they said, yeah, so those guys got stuck, but they can tell us about what we used to be like. You see, they're kind of like fossils or something. They're like, you know, they're sort of frozen in time. We've, of course, progressed, you know, many, many levels, but we can look at them as to who we used to be. So these are primitive, and these are more developed, and these are highly developed, and then we are the highest developed. Have you noticed that hierarchies always end up with the person who's making the hierarchy on top? No one ever makes a hierarchy and says, yeah, I'm kind of in the middle. So anyway, this was to privilege. The criteria was privileging certain aspects of culture and deprivileging others in order to make the hierarchy. So basically it was technology, really technology. So of course, you know, came out on top because we are more technical than, you know, people who use spears and stuff like that. But deprivileging things like mythology, complex mythology. I mean, the Aboriginals have amazing, you know, and so-called primitive peoples in traditional cultures, amazingly complex mythological systems. Art, you know, amazing, like, you know, artistic things, like things like that. Kinship systems. The kinship systems of, you know, these so-called primitive peoples are way more complex than the kinship systems of, you know, so-called more advanced people. So you just privilege one thing over another. And that's the way it is with our interactions with others, too. We think that we're better than someone else. We think that we're better than someone else, sort of wholly, generically better, because we're more intelligent. We just privilege one aspect. Say, okay, well, I've got more intelligence than they are, a higher IQ or something like that. Therefore, I'm better altogether. But they're better. He's saying, yeah, everyone's got some good qualities. They're better at many, many things than you are, you see. But you just don't, you don't count them. You don't think, well, that's not important to be better at car mechanics. Or that's not important to be better at, you know, at painting or something like that. It's important to be good at, you know, scholarship and intelligence and, you know, IT systems. So you two here is saying, look, everyone's got some qualities. I'm worse than some and better than others. I'm not the lowest here. You know, why is this person thinking of me as the lowest? Who's that? Who's this person, by the way? You won. Okay? You, at the beginning of the meditation. You too is the person that's talking here. Looking back at you one. Okay? Due to the power of the mental afflictions. Due to the power of the mental afflictions, not in my control. So now here he's morphed into, from 143 to 144, he's talking about a particular kind of hierarchical relationship, of feeling superior spiritually to other people. So you one may think that you're better than you two because you come to retreats at Barabador and listen to teachings on the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Okay? And then, you know, you practice, you know, your ethical life and you become like a nice person, you know, good, a good person. The goal is not to be good. The goal is to be free. Okay? The goal is to be free of all hierarchies like that. Anyway, due to the power of the mental afflictions, not in my control, my morality and worldview have declined. All these people that we're looking down, you one is looking down upon spiritually, they can't help it. See, mental afflictions are out of our control, right? Especially without training, especially without the privilege of, you know, getting teachings like this. They're out of our control. So I can't help it. I wish to be cured. And then he says, you know, I don't like being like this. People who, you know, are having unhappy lives, people who are having all kinds of problems, people who are unclear about what makes for a good life, they don't want to live like that. I wish to be cured to the extent possible and agree to put up with any inconvenience. And if I can't be cured, why do you despise me? Why don't you help me, in other words, he's saying here. You know, you're supposed to be all like spiritually superior to me, having taken all these teachings and going to Dalai Lama teachings and going on retreats and, you know, going on meditation retreats. You're supposed to be superior to me. Why don't you help me? And if you don't help me, if I can't be cured, why do you despise me? If there's nothing you can do for me, if you can't fix me, if you can't bring me up to your level, why then do you despise me? Why, you know, it's your problem. It's your failure. You have all of this, you know, like privilege, and you're not helping me, and so, you know, why do you despise me like that? It's very clever. You know, it's very intricate, psychologically intricate. And if I can't be cured, why do you despise me? This one's good qualities, this one is who? You one. It, no use to me. Don't help me at all. Where is the compassion for people living in the jaws of beasts of prey in miserable circumstances? So you're looking back at the you one, you two, say, where's your compassion for me? You know, sitting there all high and mighty, especially spiritually. These verses are directly targeted at spiritual hierarchies. The idea that, you know, spiritually you're better than another person. What? Where's your compassion? Proud of his good qualities, he strives to surpass even the learned, the panditas, even the great scholars. All right, you want to give it a go? All right, first of all, in order to do this meditation, you've got to think about somebody that you feel superior to in one sense or another. And that, and it would help if, I think, you know, necessary maybe, for the person that you're thinking about that you feel superior to, them kind of knowing that you actually are superior to them in this regard. You know, not ontologically, not like universally. Not in every regard, but in some sense or another. I mean, the advanced students here can do this with the spiritual person. Can do this with a, you know, spiritually. You can think about somebody that, you know, you think is just kind of a bad person, spiritually. And somebody that knows you, and knows that you come on retreats to Borobudur, and, you know, it's like, well, you know, why should they feel so high and mighty, you know, going to all those retreats, like that. If you want to do it a little more easily, I think, you can just think about somebody who's poorer than you, somebody who has less money than you, or less advantage in one way or another, less education or something like that. But somebody that you know, and that you sort of, you know, believe pretty clearly, it has the sense that they know too, that you are more intelligent, richer, or whatever it is, okay? Can you think of anyone like that? Meditation's not going to work unless you can, like, identify somebody like that. So take a minute and think about it. I always do it with people who don't have PhDs. Maybe haven't even finished high school, you know? I know people like that. All right, here we go. So just, you know, take a deep breath, close your eyes, put yourself in the here and now. Don't think about anything else. Just try this exercise. Picture the person that you were thinking about in your mind's eye. You know, think about where they usually encounter them. See them there. Try to get their image in your mind's eye very clearly. And then think about what it is that, you know, you feel superior to them about. And then try to extend yourself with them. Put yourself fully into their being. Be them. And then look back at the former you. You are now them. So you're looking back at someone who is really not you anymore. Was you, but not you now. And try and see, try to see your former self with the eyes of someone who is envious of you. Someone who feels belittled by you, at least in this one regard. And then look back at yourself with those eyes. And then come back to you one and look back at you two and think how awful it must be to feel that way. how terrible to have a mental affliction like that. Envy. So the meditation really requires you to really feel what it's like to have a mental affliction like envy, and then to come back to the self and say, that's no way to feel at all. That's a terrible way to feel. I'm so sorry that they feel that way. Okay, we're just testing, okay? But, you know, this is a takeaway. This is something you could take home and try, like over and over again. This is a really good one to do when you encounter people like this in real life, you see? And then maybe you go home and say, like, oh, how must they feel about me? How must an uneducated person feel when they meet somebody with a PhD? Or how must the person who's overweight and all of that feel when they see a beautiful yogi like me? See, how do they feel? Envious, right? How does a person feel who, you know, has no clue about how to live a good life and they encounter me who has got like all these certainties, spiritual certainties, about what the right way is to live, and all of these opportunities to, you know, study and go on retreats and take teachings. How must they feel? Okay, you ready for the next one? So like I said, I mean, the key here is actually to get very, very deep into the mental affliction. To feel it very, very viscerally. So in this case, we were feeling envy very, very viscerally. The next one is to feel this kind of rivalry, this sense of competitiveness or rivalry. So these are the verses on exchanging self for those equal to you, more or less equal to you. When he sees others, so who's talking now? You too. Okay? So now you've exchanged yourself with a competitor. You've exchanged yourself with a peer. With whom you are in rivalry, okay? So when these verses are that new you talking, you two talking, not you one. You two talking about you one. Okay, got it? I think it's confusing. When he sees others equaling himself, when you one sees that I'm starting to become as equal as they as he or she is. He tries to enhance his own superiority by obtaining acquisitions and honor for himself. To stay ahead, see. When he sees like somebody coming up to the same level, then tries to like, you know, get whatever it is that's going to keep him in ahead of me. Even if it involves disputation. Kalaha means contention, strife, fighting, quarreling. Were my good qualities, who's me? You too. The person, the rival that you're exchanging yourself with. Were my good qualities to be widely known to the world, then no one would even hear of his good qualities. Who's his in the last, you won. Okay, so you're using rivalry. You're using this sense of competitiveness as a path, as a way to like understand what it feels like to others who are in competition with you. Understand how they look at you with a mental affliction. Were my faults to be concealed, don't we all like that, don't we? We all like our faults to be concealed. Were my faults to be concealed, I would be honored, not him. Today I have easily obtained acquisitions, and it is I who am honored, not him. Happily we will watch him at last be abused, ridiculed, and reviled by everyone in all kinds of places. I'll really put him down, or her down. Okay, you get it? You get the idea here? So once again, we'll just do a little, you know, quick exercise on this. First of all, you have to feel... You have to, you know, identify somebody in your life that you feel in competition with. maybe competitive for a job, maybe competitive for honor, maybe competitive for recognition. You know, in sanghas, there's all kinds of competitiveness that goes on. Who's closer to the teacher? You know, who does more meditation? Who has reached level 3 of the 10-part levels of meditation? And who's only reached 2? Okay? So, think about somebody that you feel, you know, not friendly with, okay? It's not a friendly person. It's not your friend. It's your competitor. Close your eyes and bring them into your mind's eye. Put them right in front of you. And then exchange yourself. You one becomes you two and looks back at the former you as an object, not as the subject, but as an object. So from the point of view of your new self, how does your old self look? And try and cultivate strongly that feeling, that mental affliction of that sense of competitiveness and rivalry and that strong desire to be ahead, to get ahead. And look at the other person look at the former you as your rival. Then come back to you one and just reflect for a moment, you know, what you look like to a person who's in competition with you. Difficult? Well, the former you two is in competition with you one. Yeah. They what? They weren't competing? Well, you're not doing it right.
No, but she's saying when she. Is this right, that when you went into their shoes, you realized that you, one, was the competitive one?
Oh, yeah. I see. Yeah. Well, yeah. No, and that's how we feel. Yeah, that's how we feel. We kind of deny our own competitiveness and attribute competitiveness to others. But we're actually competitive, too.
Yeah.
So you're learning how, in a way, you're learning something about yourself by thinking about you from another person's point of view. So when you're looking back at your former self, you one, from the point of view of you two, you see what you as a competitor and a rival look like. Oh, they're always trying to get ahead. They're always trying to impress the boss, you know, all like that.
It's almost like you can see your own subconscious, you know, like you, the airs and graces, but what it's hiding from the point of view of someone else. I don't know, what you can sort of see into your own subconscious.
Yeah. Look, I mean, you can't do this meditation successfully unless envy, competitiveness, and pride are already in you. Right? Because you don't know how they feel otherwise. And of course, they all are in us. We all have all the mental afflictions. So you're also getting in touch with your own mental afflictions. Well, it's very, very complex and clever meditation. But like I said, very rarely taught. I remember I taught this early on when I was first started teaching in Los Angeles, and very confused. I was very confused about this meditation. So I went down to a temple, a Tibetan Buddhist temple, and I talked to the Lama there, Geshe Gyaltsen. And I told him, you know, I'm teaching exchanging self for others to my students. And he said, don't do that. It's not literal. He kept on saying, not literal. He's like, he didn't want us to actually do it. Just like read about it a little bit and then, you know, go home and, you know, forget about it, basically. No, because it's like so tricky. It's such an interesting and tricky meditation. And the Tibetan Lamas, as usual, underestimate us. For good reason, often. But they don't kind of feel like we're ready for advanced teachings like this. I mean, this is not a secret text or anything. But this is actually using a technique that's found in secret texts. This is a tantric technique, actually, of using mental afflictions, you know, as a path in order to destroy mental afflictions. So you're using a mental affliction as it's seen from the point of view of another person to destroy it in you. Right? Very tricky. All right, so next one is exchanging self for those superior to you, which is using pride as a path. So we used envy as a path with those we regard as lesser than us, inferior. Use competitiveness or rivalry as with those that we regard as peers. And then here we're using pride. So this wretched little person is so envious of me. Who's speaking here? You too. Okay? Somebody who's richer than you, more successful, somebody who, you know, has better meditation techniques than you do, somebody who can do bakasana better than you can do. This wretched little person is so envious of me. Does he have the learning, wisdom, good looks, family standing, or wealth that I have? No. I can't help it. I'm so good at bakasana. And then they sit around envying me. It's so unfair that they would envy, you know, something I'm quite good at. Very successful at this. And from now on, I will enjoy a festival of happiness. Thrilled with my hair standing on end to hear my good qualities celebrated. So glad everyone says, like, all the other yoga students are talking about how awesome my bakasana is. So wonderful. I celebrate it. I revel in that. You know, pride. Taking pride. If he has acquisitions, we will forcibly seize them. So, you know, he's shifting around here a little bit. He's not like saying, look, if someone else starts to, you know, climb up a little bit, we'll just like bat him down or her down. You know, pride. Don't want them to even come close to equaling me. So, you know, I'm a rich person. If they start getting wealthy, we'll take away all their stuff. And if he comes to work for us, we'll pay him just enough to live on. So he doesn't get ahead. He doesn't get above his station. Isn't that the expression? So the person doesn't get above their station. We'll strip him of his happiness and always saddle him with pain. For we all have suffered at his hands hundreds of times in this cycle of pain. These lowlifes have brought us nothing but problems in the past. Who's talking here? You too. All right, this one's in some ways the hardest, okay? Because we don't like to think of anyone superior to us. So be honest here, okay? And do an easy one. Somebody who has, like, way more money than you do, okay? Way more professional standing. Someone who's way more intelligent than you. Somebody that you saw at the Asian Yoga Conference in Hong Kong who is just way better than you at asana. I mean, just way better. If you don't think there are such people, you should, like, get out more. You know what I mean? If you don't think, like, you're anyone more beautiful than you are, you go to a Miss America contest or, Miss Universe contest. Look at how beautiful everyone is. Way beautiful than you are. If you think you're so good at yoga, go to an international yoga conference. Way better people than you doing awesome. If you think you're so smart, go to Oxford. Hang around in Oxford University and talk to real eggheads. Okay? So there are people who are better than you. So in this case, I think it's probably best to choose somebody who's way better than you in something that you want to be better at. Okay? Yeah. So, you one is envious of you two. Okay? And now we're going to exchange self for others, and you two will be proud of what they are better at than you one. Got it? So the mental affliction that we're cultivating here is pride. Okay. All right. So, find somebody, pick somebody, give it a go here, picture them in front of you, think kind of clearly about how good they are at something that you want to be good at, how much better they are than you are. And then do the exchanging self for others. You one becomes you two. And then look back at you one from the point of view of pride. And how nasty it is to have an envious little bugger like you one in your life. Okay. Three forms of exchanging self for other. Fabulous meditation. Unbelievable. Who thought that up? That's what I want to know. Some genius thought that up. Genius. So that's a real takeaway. That's a very practical meditation. You can use that on a pretty much of a daily basis with all the different kinds of people that we encounter, Put yourself in their position and look at you from with their eyes. And you learn something about them, and you learn something about yourself. And the ultimate, of course, the ultimate purpose of this meditation, remember what the function is of this meditation, is to gain this sense of universal equality. We all have mental afflictions. Everyone has mental afflictions. All non-Buddhas have mental afflictions. That's why we're not Buddhas. So we all equally have mental affliction. If somebody's envious of you, you know how that feels because you've been envious of other people. So put yourself in their position and feel how nasty it feels to feel envious. And then take that back and say, and I don't want to feel envious towards others either. It doesn't feel nice to feel envious. Proud, you know. It doesn't feel nice to be like proud and not caring about other people who are lesser than you. Yeah, very interesting meditation. Okay? So we'll finish off tonight, Chapter 8, with just a kind of cleanup. That's the main part of Chapter 8. That's what Shantideva tells us to meditate on in his chapter on the perfection of meditation. Of all the different things that he could have told us on what to meditate on, that's the one. Because that's one of the methods for achieving bodhicitta. Yeah, no, sweetheart, we just did it. So exercise for class 3 is to just do those meditations. And, you know, I hope you do these exercises sometime. You know, when we're here and everything's happening fast and furious, but, you know, my idea for these four class courses is to do it over 4 weeks, minimal. So that each week you're doing, you know, a daily version of each exercise that's connected to the class, the particular class, so that you get some of the juice out of it, you know, so you get some experience of it. Okay, 6:30. See you. We only have an hour, but we do have, like, before next class, we have some singing. So we'll start next class with kirtan.